This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell. Today we'll be hearing from Eve Samples, Executive Director of Friends of the Everglades. Eve joined Friends of the Everglades in 2020 after 2 decades working as a journalist. She's a native of Miami and a graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Friends of the Everglades, alongside partnered organizations, has been in the midst of litigation against Alligator Alcatraz, a theatrically titled immigrant detention center being constructed in Big Cypress National Preserve. Just last week, a 14-day restraining order requested by the plaintiffs was granted, temporarily halting construction. In the wake of these waves of litigation, we have Eve Samples with us now. Eve, thank you for joining us, especially at such a busy time for your organization.
Thanks for inviting me.
Could you tell us a bit more about what brought you to Friends of the Everglades?
Sure. I was a journalist for 20 years working in daily newspapers, and the last 10 of those 20 years, I wrote quite a bit about environmental issues, including an issue related to Everglades restoration involving the discharge of polluted water from Lake Okeechobee that caused toxic algae blooms in an estuary, two estuaries actually connected to the lake. And writing about that crisis really captured my heart and my imagination in deeper ways. And when I had an opportunity to work on the front lines of environmental advocacy in early 2020, I welcomed it. Friends of the Everglades was actually founded by a former journalist and writer, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas. She's a real hero in Florida's environmental history. And the more I learned about Marjorie, the more I was inspired to attempt to follow in her footsteps there. Very big footsteps.
As an organization, how is Friends of the Everglades structured and how does it go about accomplishing its work?
Yeah, we're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and we've been a grassroots organization since Marjorie founded Friends in 1969. Actually, and we'll get to this, she founded Friends of the Everglades to protect the very area where the Everglades Detention Center is being built. So we were small working board, some limited staff for many years. And it really wasn't until early 2020 that we started to build out our staff, our paid staff a little bit. So we now have 9 full-time employees. That is 3 times as many as we had 5 years ago. And we, I think, are seeing a real desire among Floridians and people around the country for the type of environmental accountability we do. Our mission is to preserve, protect, and restore the only Everglades in the world. And under that mission, we have a goal of compelling government agencies to uphold existing environmental laws and not weaken laws on the books. Also holding politicians accountable for the long consequences of their actions and then spreading awareness about the importance of the Everglades ecosystem is our third goal. So I think there's a desire for that kind of work. We're not growing just for the sake of growth. We're growing to serve our mission. And we see now that there's a real urgent need to make sure that our government is looking out for our public lands and our environmental interests in this country. It's a moment where there's a lot of reason for concern.
You had previously said it, but your organization was founded and operates on the understanding that there is only one Everglades. Do any personal experiences in the Everglades come to mind for you that exemplify the unique character of that landscape?
Yes, absolutely. The one that I think about most often is a swamp walk I did out in Big Cypress National Preserve, actually. I'm only about 5'3", so the waters were pretty deep that day for me. It came up almost to my waist. And this area is actually just about 6 miles west of where the detention center that we're fighting now is. But during that swamp walk, we were with a guide. And you might think that when you go on a swamp walk or sluice log in the Everglades, you would get mucky and muddy and your shoes would come out dirty. But actually, you're walking on limestone bottom. The water, at least where I was, very clear, tannin stained, but clear. And your shoes come out cleaner. And when you're in that water, it really feels like an immersion into this incredible ecosystem. We were under a dome of ancient cypress trees with bromeliads, epiphytes on the trees, clinging to the trees, ferns, lush vegetation. I felt a a serenity immersed in the Everglades in that way, and would highly recommend anyone traveling near the Everglades and go on engage in that experience. I went out of Clyde Butcher's gallery right there on Tamiami Trail, and there are some wonderful guides there, but there are other places you can do it, including Everglades National Park.
And that was right in the area that is set to be impacted by this project.
That's right. I keep thinking about that experience in the context of this. There's some irony in the fact that the state of Florida, working with the federal government, picked this location because they see it as inhospitable and a place that people would never attempt to escape into because of alligators and snakes. And actually, those of us who love the Everglades, choose to do that and quite enjoy it.
For those who might not be completely familiar, could you describe this project a little more? What is Alligator Alcatraz and what is constituted in its construction?
Yes, so maybe I'll take you back to the day I first learned about it. I remember it very well because I was driving back from the Florida Keys with one of my colleagues. We were doing some work down there, meeting with scientists, filming some video out on Florida Bay, which is just south of Everglades National Park. Part of Florida Bay is in the park. We're driving north on the highway back to the mainland when my colleague was looking at social media and saw something about a detention center, an immigrant detention center in the Everglades. And we both kind of scoffed initially because certainly something of that magnitude, that kind of potential negative impact would have been vetted. There would have been public hearings, public input, and we hadn't heard any of that. And we found out in short order that, in fact, the state and federal governments were serious about this, that it was something of a political stunt in its naming. And I think you called it theatrically titled in your intro there, and that resonates. It was a stunt, and they were serious, as it turned out. So that's how we learned about it. And that was June 17th that I first heard. And by June 22nd, I was out there with members of the Miccosukee tribe and other concerned citizens who were protesting peacefully out in front of the site. And on June 23rd, the day after that, construction started. And in about 8 days, they had a real critical mass out there. Again, none of this with any public input or concern for the ecologically sensitive footprint that this site is surrounded by. It's surrounded by Big Cypress National Preserve.
You've already painted a pretty vivid image of it, but for listeners who maybe have never visited the region, could you describe the landscape of Big Cypress National Preserve?
Yes, so it's an interesting area because, unlike your incredible national parks out west that are pretty isolated, Everglades National Park and Big Cypress National Preserve are not a very far drive from densely populated areas in South Florida and also Southwest Florida. So, to drive from Miami out into Big Cypress, it's about an hour, give or take, and it's you leave the dense urban area and you are driving west on Tamiami Trail from Miami, and you enter this big sky open area of sawgrass plains. And then the closer you get to Big Cypress as you go west towards Naples, you start to see cypress trees lining that two-lane road. And cypress trees, I find them so charming because they have these little cypress knees that poke up through the dark waters, and that foliage, that flora becomes more apparent as you get farther west. And then you get into the Big Cypress National Preserve, which is habitat for Florida panther. There's a famous scenic drive called Loop Road that runs through Big Cypress National Preserve. It's a great drive. It actually cuts through three counties and habitat, including cypress strand, sawgrass prairies. You'll definitely see alligators on Loop Road. And if you're interested in making that drive, go to our website, everglades.org, and you can see kind of a photo essay that one of our staffers documented as part of that drive. So really incredible place. It's varied. The Everglades, I think some people think it's because it's flat, it's homogeneous, and if you've seen one part of the Everglades, you've seen it all. But Big Cypress, which is part of the Greater Everglades, it's very different than Everglades National Park, and really a beautiful place. Also, home to the ghost orchid, a very elusive and special species of orchid, and the Florida bonneted bat is another species in the area that is endangered. It's just a stunningly beautiful place.
And as I understand it, and I think you mentioned it, the exact location we're discussing here is significant to the history of Friends of the Everglades. Could you tell us a bit about the roots the organization has at this site?
Yes, this is really our origin story at Friends of the Everglades. So when this threat emerged, it was very clear that we needed to take action with our partners to halt it. So Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, our founder, had been involved in the creation of Everglades National Park. She was on the committee to create the park. That was in 1947 that Harry Truman dedicated the park. She also wrote the book The Everglades River of Grass, which was published the same year, 1947, and really changed much of the world's perception of the Everglades from this swampy wasteland to be conquered and drained to a national treasure to be protected. She really honored the indigenous perspective in that book in a way that was remarkable, especially in 1947. Marjorie herself was remarkable. Apart from her environmental advocacy, she was a crusader for equal rights, a suffragist, really notable person and inspiring to follow in her lead. So she was already 79 years old in 1969 when the world's largest airport was proposed for what's now Big Cypress National Preserve. So she'd written her book, she'd been part of the creation of Everglades National Park, and she wasn't inclined to take on another huge project until she was approached about helping to stop the jet port. This Everglades jet port, as it was called, would have been 5 times the size of JFK International in New York. And it was extremely alarming. And back then, we didn't have some bedrock environmental laws that forced an environmental study and scientific analysis. However, a study was done called the Leopold Report, and that study became really instrumental in halting the project. So Marjorie founded Friends of the Everglades in 1969. And by 1970, after that Leopold Report was published and Friends of the Everglades was formed, Richard Nixon, of all people, actually halted the jet port from being built in early 1970 because the environmental harm was recognized. The asterisk to that victory is that it was halted after one runway was built, a 10,000-foot runway. I actually have a framed picture of that runway in my office and have had it here for years because I look at it and the sense of how much worse it could have been if that whole airport was built in the middle of what's now Big Cypress National Preserve. And I also look at it as a victory. You know, we stopped it at that, and that runway is where this detention center has been erected, and there's been additional asphalt and construction around it in the days since, unfortunately. So I'll just add one more thing. After the jet port was halted in 1970, Big Cypress National Preserve was established as our country's first national preserve in 1974. And that was because the jet port battle illustrated how special it was and why it was worth protecting.
So several endangered species rely on this area's habitat. And you've mentioned a few of them. What populations or communities is your organization particularly concerned about?
The Florida panther is certainly chief among them. There are only about 200 Florida panther left in the wild, and they've had a bit of a comeback story in recent decades, thank God. But the panther is still very fragile. And one thing we have documented at the detention center site, as you might imagine, is very intense lighting. Industrial style lighting has been put up at the site where we once had some of the best dark skies in the southeastern United States. Now you can see what looks like a stadium about 15 miles away. The Florida panther is a nocturnal species, so that's extremely concerning for the panther, as is the intense increase in traffic that we've seen at the site, noise. Vehicle collisions are the number one cause of panther mortality, so it's a serious concern. And we know from telemetry data that tracks panthers that have radio collars, that panthers have used this property. They have been tracked on this property where the detention center has been built. We heard in court last week from a Florida panther expert who talked about how a typical male panther needs about 200 square miles to roam for territory. And when you displace panthers from this specific area, as has happened because of the impacts at this detention center, there's the risk of interspecies attacks. So, you'll certain male panthers could be displaced into other territory, and you can have interspecies attacks. So, really concerning. I also mentioned the Florida bonneted bat. That's another big concern in this area. Last week, we were in court for 2 days, and we heard from experts testifying on this. In addition to the lighting I mentioned, we also have documented about 20 acres of new asphalt that has been laid on this site. And we know that from a very heroic pilot who has been volunteering his time to fly and take videos and photos from the air. And we've chronicled, working with Everglades hydrologist Dr. Christopher McVoy, the expansion of the footprint of asphalt out there. The state of Florida and the federal government have been leaning into this narrative that this was already a disturbed area. This was an existing footprint. We're not doing anything harmful. And the evidence simply doesn't substantiate that narrative. So the additional asphalt was laid not on top of a concrete pad, as the state has been saying. But on top of a permeable surface that was some kind of limestone subsurface. So when you lay asphalt on top of a permeable surface, of course you get runoff from the water. And the property is 96% wetlands. So when you get runoff from asphalt, and now you have thousands of cars parked on it, it's a giant parking lot because you have detention center staff and all the other employees out there. Pollutants run into the waterways, and the Everglades are a vast interconnected system of wetlands. It's very concerning. And the Everglades are also our drinking water supply in South Florida. So none of this was analyzed. It's outrageous. In fact, we heard from another expert witness in court this past week who testified to basically the non-existence of any stormwater system for this new asphalt. If you lay a parking lot in South Florida, you have to have a stormwater system to make sure you're dealing with the runoff, and it's just not there. So pretty brazen by the government to lay this new asphalt and do this construction without even a permit, much less compliance with the National Environmental Policy Act, which is what we sued under. So those are the biggies. New asphalt, light pollution, noise and traffic are certainly concerns as well.
Could you tell me a bit more about those photographs that you mentioned, documenting kind of the site as the construction has taken place?
Yes, it was a really vivid moment in court this past Thursday when Dr. McVoy, Everglades hydrologist I mentioned, was narrating aerial video footage that was shown in the courtroom. And these photographs fly over the site, and it really illustrates how watery this area is, how flood prone to. And then you get to a two particular large sections of new asphalt that have been laid at the site since construction started, and then some new roadways too that have been laid.
You mentioned that these parks areas are already in really close proximity to urban developed areas. So there's kind of already a precedent set of understanding what the impact of that kind of stormwater could or that runoff could be. What kind of impacts are being seen already in the Everglades area in response to pollutant runoff?
The Everglades are very intolerant of phosphorus and nitrogen. This has been the subject of Everglades restoration efforts for decades. It was phosphorus pollution, partly from the sugarcane industry in the Everglades, and other sources, but phosphorus pollution has led to this kind of monoculture in some areas of cattails. And when you have an imbalance or too many nutrient pollutants that are in the waterways, it can really trigger this domino effect that disrupts the ecosystem, starting with the vegetation.
Sure. And you had mentioned light pollution, and that the area is designated as an International Dark Sky Park. What is the significance of that designation?
That is significant not just for us humans who enjoy stargazing and the night skies, and one of the very few places in Florida and in all of the southeastern United States where you can really experience dark skies away from city lights. But it's also really important for nocturnal species. And again, another valuable facet of this region that, I mean, there's ecotourism value in addition to the recreational value. And it was completely disregarded by the state and federal government when they ramrodded this facility into the heart of Big Cypress National Preserve without so much as a public hearing or even a
Right.
public comment period.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about that kind of that lack of review process. How has this project gone about dodging the typical review process mandated by the National Environmental Policy Act that you'd expect?
Yes, so many ways. So the National Environmental Policy Act is a bedrock law in our country. It was actually born after that fight to stop the jet port from being built in Big Cypress. So also in 1970, that was a time of environmental awakening in our country. So you had the National Environmental Policy Act signed into law. You had the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act. EPA was created, and it was a really critical time where our country stitched together this fabric of protections. And now I'm thinking a lot about how this moment we're in is a moment where we're testing whether the fabric will hold. And I think our lawsuit really speaks to that. But back to your question about National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA for short. NEPA is a very common sense law. It's even conservative principles, if you'd like to think of it that way. It requires the government to look before it leaps to make sure that it's analyzing the impacts of a federal action, and in this case, the construction and operation of a detention center in the Everglades. And as part of that looking before it leaps, it has to do an environmental impact study. It has to take public comment and respond to it. And it also has to consider alternatives. And that includes the no action alternative to make sure that no action wouldn't be the best course. So, going back to that jet port battle, although NEPA wasn't in place, there was that report, scientific report called the Leopold Report, that did change the course of that project. And that became kind of a precursor for a NEPA review. So, it really illustrates that when we slow down and make intentional decisions with the right information, that it can really alter the course for the better. And that's what NEPA does at its heart. I think NEPA isn't quite as well known to lay people as the Endangered Species Act or the Clean Water Act, but it really is the undergirding of so many of our protections in this country, and really critical for the government to comply with it. Environmental laws are just as important as other laws in this country. And there's some irony in the fact that this detention center has been purportedly built with the intention of enforcing the rule of law, but it has flouted the rule of environmental law and being built. So, yes, it's NEPA is critical. We at Friends of the Everglades have been involved in many NEPA review processes over the years. In some cases, our comments and other projects have resulted in better outcomes.
And so how are the people pushing for this project? How is that a process avoided?
Yes, that is a question we are grappling with in court. It's unbelievable that the state and federal government, and remember, immigration is a federal duty. And this is an immigration detention facility, so this is a federal project. What we're hearing from the state and federal government in court is kind of this wild two-step where they're trying to claim that this is a state project because the state built it, even though there are many instances of on-the-record statements from people at the highest levels of our government, federal government and state government, who say that the federal government is paying for this, that FEMA funds will be used for reimbursement, and that the federal government requested this. We heard testimony in court this week about the federal government requesting it. So they're trying to sidestep their responsibility by claiming that this is a state project, not a federal project, but the record does not substantiate that.
So, in litigating this, Friends of the Everglades has partnered with several other organizations, including the Center for Biological Diversity. Could you tell us a bit about the lawsuit that was filed earlier this summer, around June 27th?
That's right. That was the day, June 27th. So we and Center for Biological Diversity filed the suit under the National Environmental Policy Act, and we were seeking an injunction to halt activity at the site so that a NEPA review can be completed as required by law. Our co-counsel is Earth Justice. It's great to stand with their great attorneys in court. And then we also have representation from Coffey Burlington, a law firm in Miami that's done environmental work over the years. And we have a wonderful team. And we had a preliminary win last week when the judge decided to grant this 14-day temporary restraining order that really illustrates the urgency of this issue. The judge saw that dump trucks of fill were continuing to roll onto the site just in the days leading up to our injunction hearings. And she didn't want to see that continue over the weekend. So she issued this restraining order at our request. And we're back in court on Tuesday, August 12th, for our injunction hearing to continue. We also filed a notice of intent to sue on July 11th under the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Water Act, and the National Parks Organic Act. Under those laws, you have to give the government 60 days notice before you sue, so that legal action is also pending.
In the wake of this recent win and in seeking injunction, what is on the horizon for this fight?
Yes, so we're back in court on the injunction hearing and hopeful that the judge will see the merits in that case, as she did with the temporary restraining order. And the hope is that activity, this harmful activity that's continuing at the site, will be halted so that an environmental impact study can be completed as the law requires. And I think that study will show that this is not a good place for a facility, any harmful facility. And the nature of a 24/7 detention facility, it's really intense and harmful. And I think we're finding that people of all political stripes, are not happy with the government's actions here.
Sure. Speaking on the National Environmental Policy Act and generally the way that whole review process functions, if the suit is successful in granting additional review and environmental analysis, how can the public contribute to that process once that review has been done and ensure that their voice is heard after the fact?
Yes. So at Friends of the Everglades, we help keep people informed about how and when to engage in that process because it is tedious. And if you're not tracking it full time, it can be hard to know when you have an opportunity as a member of the public to weigh in. So I'd say, with regard to Alligator Alcatraz, go to everglades.org, sign up for our emails. We will absolutely alert folks to when they can provide public comment. And those comments are really important. And in the meantime, we do have a form on our website, everglades.org, where people can message Governor DeSantis and Florida's Attorney General James F. Meyer to tell them they oppose the project.
Sure. Okay. Are there any other ways that community members, whether in the state of Florida or as invested onlookers from across the country, are there any ways right now that they can help?
I think the silver lining to all of this is that more people are thinking about the Everglades and the value of the Everglades, and also this moment that we stand in as a country where our public lands are under threat. These battles that we fought and won decades ago, in the case of the Jetport 56 years ago, they're being relitigated, and the public didn't ask for that. So I think staying engaged, holding on to these glimmers of optimism. We got so much good feedback after our restraining order was granted last Thursday because I think people are hungry for evidence that the government is being held accountable. And that, yes, it was a 14-day restraining order, and we have a lot more work to do. But it's a sign of hope that the rule of law can prevail and that our public lands can be protected, that environmental laws and regulations can be followed. So I'd say choose your lane, whether you're in Montana or Florida, choose your lane, choose the issue, the environmental issue that you want to track and stay engaged on it. Choose your favorite organization, get the emails, issue public comment when you have the opportunity, and then get out there and enjoy the ecosystems that you love, because I think that's what keeps us all going.
Thank you to Eve Samples for sharing her insight today and to all the folks involved in the fight against Alligator Alcatraz. It is inspiring to see the legacy of grassroots environmentalism at Big Cypress National Preserve continue. This has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. More information about the association and its activities can be found at its website, www.gallatinwildlife.org. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to kgvm.org or to buzzsprout.com and scroll down to Wilderness and Wildlife. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Ben Churchwell.